From Buffalo Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, Producer Picks. Highlights of conversations heard on previous episodes. On today's show,
we had a lot of good feedback. So when we post about information about it, a lot of people we run across who are dealing with stress management, or when we present on dealing with anxiety and depression, we talk about our boot camp and people are like, what's that about? Oh, that sounds good because I think I'm stressed because of me and my partner aren't getting along. And so conversation comes up and we just go from there.
Wow. Yeah. Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis of Walking Through Solutions, LLC. And we close with,
what are the things that you are consuming socially within your area, within your surroundings, the things you hear, the things you're watching and listening to on social media and television and so forth? I think those have a significant impact on some of our decision making.
Andre Stokes, the Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health. I'm Michael Loss. First, we revisit Jay Moran's conversation with Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis of Walking Through Solutions, LLC, as they discuss the group's four-week couples boot camps and how it helps solve issues within relationships and build a stronger foundation.
You hold these four-week couples boot camps.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about what exactly is entailed in a boot camp for couples.
Okay, I'll start because the couples boot camp is really like my baby.
All right.
With our business.
How'd you come up with the idea?
Just watching TV, watching my friends obsess about these like dating shows. And it's so many dating shows on TV and people really get invested. And I'm like, you know, people don't, you know, like to do couples counseling. It's not like the trendy thing to do. So I was like, well, why can't I make it something that is in Buffalo and something that people can actually participate in using my social work background, but also making it engaging and not just like a seminar where you're sitting there and I'm just throwing information at you. So that's how we created it.
And I think another portion of it was we listened to people who are in relationships and the relationships don't work and they have different expectations. So we drew up this outline of why people don't manage their relationships. So we hit different topics that is very important that people complain about. So we combined all that together and Deja was like, let's do a 4-week boot camp.
4 weeks of it. All right. So as we talk about it, I always have the sense that it's easier to say, hey, I'm going to go to a therapist. I'm going to go to someone who's going to give me some counseling. But to say I'm going to go with it with my partner, my spouse, is a whole other thing. So how do you come about the people who decide to take this step and be part of these boot camps? So where do they come from?
All over.
Yeah?
People find us.
Mm-hmm. They're finding you.
Right. I think when we did our first initial one, we had a lot of good feedback. So when we post about information about it, a lot of people we run across who are dealing with stress management, or when we present on dealing with anxiety and depression, we talk about our boot camp and people are like, what's that about? Oh, that sounds good because I think I'm stressed because of me and my partner aren't getting along. And so conversation comes up and we just go from there.
Wow. Yeah. But so it doesn't matter where they could be from anywhere, but they seem to find their way here and they show up agreeable, both partners agreeable, ready to do this. Is that what we see or not necessarily?
It's voluntary. but you can. So up front, we pre-screen all the couples because we want to make sure for safety purposes that we don't have any domestic violence concerns, that situation. Mm. Then as far as like just so they understand really what to expect and if they're on board with the process. Because you only get what you put into it.
Certainly.
So we go over that, and then we're at the next step. Once we accept them, they pay up front. So that is their showing their commitment as well. Because it's like, is this something that you guys both want and that you financially want to invest in your relationship? And once people take that step, they tend to be there. Whether they're happy, you know, you go through, it's so intimate and so emotional. It's an emotional ride. So like you can see the ups and downs as you're interacting with the couples and the different workshops, depending on the topics that may hit a nerve for people. But they're invested. They invest their time. They show up and they interact with us.
Right. It's normally when we first started, it was females. Females like, oh, I'm bringing my partner. But this boot camp, we have five couples and two of the couples came initiated by the male.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So that was, and it's more men out there, like when we do our stress management, that's saying, I need this. My part, we need to do this together. Because normally when we put it out there, the woman will call in and say, I'm going to try to get my husband or my boyfriend to come. But out of this boot camp, we have two of them that the men initiated it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's an interesting and encouraging sign, I would have to say. Mm-hmm. You mentioned about expect. What should someone expect or couples expect when they sign up for boot camp?
So they will expect, they get two private one-on-one sessions with both of us.
Okay.
So that's when we're going to dive into what are the challenges that you're facing? What do you want to gain from the boot camp? Tell us more about how do we get here? So that's the first session is how do we get here? The second session is how can we move forward? What tools do you need specifically that may not be only in the workshops? It may be more tailored to this is something that we like and this is like a specific, you know, area. So we do that in the one-on-one sessions. And then the group sessions, we talk about communication. We talked about trust and goal alignment. And that's like the starting stone because the goal alignment is like, do you have the same goals? And are we on the same path going into the same direction? And if you're not, that's the big one that people are like, we need to talk about this more in our private session.
Interesting.
And then the other ones are more like tools to help you get to those goals. Right. So vulnerability, conflict resolution, because you're not going to avoid conflict, but it's how can you resolve it? How can you get through it together? And then intimacy. Intimacy looks different for every couple. Mm-hmm. And like this cohort of our boot camp is different than the last one. So like intimacy
What's
came up a lot.
It? It's just that it's different because the couples bring different issues, different dynamics.
Yeah, we let them. So we have like case study examples that we can use to illustrate some of the topics that we're talking about. But we also invite people to share what they think is an issue in their relationship if they feel comfortable. And once they share, that is where the conversation goes. So okay. Intimacy right. is a big one that we talked about, but we were able to, you know, dive into what does that look like? Is it different for you versus your partner? What fuels you? What makes you feel good versus, you know, what is like something that doesn't really turn you on or, you know, get you excited?
Right. Hmm. And we explained how intimacy is something that starts not just in the bedroom or in one-on-one. It leads up to it. So those were tools we were able to provide because we only accept our max is six couples. So this group of couples, they assumed that intimacy was in the bedroom. And so we talked about how you lead up to it so that when you are one-on-one or you're alone, you're building intimacy throughout the day. So I think that was a better understanding. And a lot of them were like, you know, we're not connected this way. We're no longer intimate with each other. And so we had them explain what that meant for them.
Right.
And that's what took us different than last time, right? You think?
Yeah. So, like I said, each couple, they bring their own experiences and dynamic to the group. And that's what we love because the couples can learn from each other and from us. We have couples that have been together for over 10 years, some that are newer couples, some that are older, some that are younger. So it just makes a nice, diverse group for discussions. And everyone has different perspectives. So that makes it even more fruitful. It's no wrong answer. But when people share their perspectives, we try to educate on, this sounds like you're saying this. This is what your partner may be hearing. This may be where you guys don't align.
Right. And I think our oldest couple is in their early 50s. And our youngest couple is in their
20s.
Late 20s.
So let's go through perhaps maybe day one of a boot camp. What are we experiencing there?
Okay. For our beginning, we do the introduction.
Okay.
We have you share whatever you're comfortable. If you don't want to share and you just want to sit here and just participate, we're fine with that.
And I can imagine there are some people initially who are just like that, right?
Right. Okay. Right. Right. And we do different interaction. One of them is where we have a clear plexiglass, and everyone gets one. You and your partner get sticky notes and write on it and say,
what are your barriers to communication?
Right.
So with our communication workshop, this is where this activity falls in.
All right.
So what are the barriers to communication? I do mine. So that could be what's stopping me from communicating with you. And then there are other things that may be like, what is something that your partner does that stops you from talking? So it's a two-way street.
Right.
And then your partner does the same thing. And so once you hold my plexiglass up to my partner's plexiglass, now you see all these things, like all the sticky notes are covering the plexiglass. So something that was once clear and you could easily see through and communicate, you know, effectively through, now it's all these barriers and hurdles of how can we hear each other? How can we listen effectively? So that's what we start with so that we can show, like, these are the issues that you guys identify as yourself. You're the expert of your own life.
Right.
And then how can we, with the, all the other workshops, I want you to chip away at each thing. How can we remove this barrier? Whether it's something that's just you, a you issue, or something that you feel like your partner does that, you know, contributes to how you respond.
Yeah. Because with this bootcamp, we also teach you how to look at the problems or the concerns that you have within yourself. It's not just about what your partner is doing or how this is coming together. It helps you identify things you need to work on.
Your relationship is, you're a mirror of your partner. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when people first come, they're like, oh, they're the problem. They're the problem.
Oh, yeah.
We're coming because of you. And then when we do these workshops, it's like you can see the shift in the atmosphere. They're like, oh, yeah, I do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I do need to work on this area. And it's
Yeah, it comes that fast. Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Over time.
All right.
So you can see how people respond differently, and I'm more open to like, oh, how can I create a safe space for my partner? How can we develop rules for like when we have a conflict? How can we, like, what are our parameters on like our deal breakers? Maybe it's when you start yelling, what is my boundary? If you yell at me, I'm going to leave the room. And I'm going to take a minute to calm down. Or, you know, they come up with their own rules, but just how can we communicate effectively so that it's me and you versus the problem and not me versus you.
Right. And after our first one-on-one, we hear the back and forth and what's going on in the relationship or what their goals are. And after whoever initiated to come to the boot camp, after our first boot camp and we meet with them again one-on-one, the person that was maybe not so excited about coming is the one that's talking, is writing down notes. They're like, wow, I never looked at it this way. That really wants to put more energy in. So for me, I'm always excited after our second one-on-one because they're like, no, when you said I need to do this, I've been trying it. And it's just really exciting for me to see.
Yeah. We give them homework. Learning opportunities.
Learning opportunities. Maybe I would have taken better care of my learning opportunities in high school if they called it that instead of homework. So I'm interested, though, about the barriers and those sticky notes, because I bet there's some pretty big things, but there might be some real small things. You do this at such and such a time, and I feel like I can't talk to you. Can you share some of those examples of some of those things that you've seen without, again, crossing that very delicate barrier into confidentiality? But I'll let you kind of gauge that for yourself.
I think one of them was, and probably in this book, I think it was in both boot camps, but a lot of it, the small ones are, when I'm talking to you, I feel like I'm not being heard. You're scrolling on your phone, or you shut down. So I think that's the small one, because although it appears that that person has shut down, they're still retaining the information. So I think the smallest thing pretty much is that they feel like they're not heard. And we give them tools. Like, if you feel like you're not being heard, you have to ask them, you know, are you hearing what I'm saying? Can you please acknowledge that you heard what I said? We don't have to talk about it now, but I feel like you heard me if you respond.
I agree. We talk about, like, some people process information, especially like highly emotional information, through talking, and some people do it through silence. And so you have to respect what your partner needs, and then your communication styles too. That comes into play. But respecting what your partner needs, they may need a 5-minute break, but they have to say, I need to take a walk. In 10 minutes, can we come back and finish this conversation? Because I'm getting a little, you know, frustrated, or this isn't going as planned. And then that way, you know what to expect, because otherwise it's like, if I shut down and I storm out of the room and you just opened up like your heart to me, now it just feels like you know, I didn't recognize that you even said anything that you said. So now you're feeling like, you know, naked. You're feeling like emotionally very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And then for me, I may have heard everything you said, but I haven't acknowledged to you. So me storming off may be like, oh, maybe they don't agree, or maybe they don't care.
Right.
But it may be them processing it.
Right.
And that's okay. But keeping each other, it's over communicating, it feels like, at first. But it's just to keep a pulse on each other. Mm-hmm. Okay, I need to take a 5-minute walk because I don't know what to say right now. And I said, it's okay to say, you know, thanks for sharing that. I don't know what to say.
Right.
You know, it sounds like there's a lot of really favorable outcomes here. But before you get to the outcome, you got to go through a lot, I'm sure, of stuff and reactions. I'm curious about those reactions. I mean, you know, are you seeing just people come, you know, like you said earlier, you know, oh, I didn't realize I did that. Wow. Uh-huh. Or somebody maybe just gets upset and mad. You know, there might be also that interpretation that you're accusing me of something that is not true. Mm-hmm. So do you have to see that kind of thing work through as well?
Yes, we see that as well. But it's normally in a one-on-one session. Okay. So they'll say, well, I feel like if there was infidelity in a relationship, they may talk about that's a huge thing. But it's not huge anymore because they've managed to still stay together. So I think that when that happens, the other partner, when they come together and they hear the tools, they're like, wow, you know, the reason why the infidelity may have come or anything may have come in this relationship is because we weren't on the same page.
I think to add on, this brings up like childhood trauma. We touch on that a lot because sometimes the things that we experience in our childhood and in our family of origin, it affects how we see the world. It affects how we engage with other people. And then how we receive love, how we receive love as a child shapes what we think love is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. And everyone has their own experience. So it shapes it. But if you don't have these conversations of like, you know, when I was a child, this happened to me. And this is why I react this way in this situation. That can create an emotional bond. But it's also like if you don't tell your partner, they don't understand. They're making their own assumptions on why you're doing that or why you're distant in this way. Mm-hmm. So mostly the work that we do, like you said, it gets ugly before it gets better.
Okay.
And if you're willing to go through the mud to get to the root of, you know, where did this come from? Why is this an issue for me? Or why is this an issue in our relationship? Then you can be like, okay, I get that. I learned so much about you that I didn't know, even though these people sometimes known each other for, you know, 10 plus years, but right. You didn't know this part of them. So that vulnerability comes in because you have to be able to say like, you know, I feel shame about this, but I'm sharing this with you. And then how can you receive the message from your partner when they share something that is like so close to their heart?
Right.
And so those things are emerging during these sessions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those and partner is saying, I had no idea.
Right.
Wow.
And a lot of it with the group session, they get to see when other people do share, they get to say, wow, it's not just us. We're not the only ones that went through this scenario.
Mm-hmm. So that is the benefit of the group session, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I would say, again, I would suspect that there's some reticence about it all. It's one thing to talk in front of the two of you with my partner.
Right.
It's another thing to talk in front of other partners.
Right.
Yep.
So they are learning from each other.
Right. And even if they don't share what actually happened in the group, when they hear somebody say, oh, yeah, we do have these arguments, or yeah, we do get distracted or don't spend as much time with each other as we should. And they'd be like, me too. You know, I didn't realize that.
And when they talk about their arguments, does one of the end products like a realization of how petty some things can be?
Yes, yes. A lot of times they'll hear it from another because we have like a lot of different interactions. So when they see the other couple say, no, because you do this or you do that, they pick up off of it and they be like, and seeing somebody else go through it, they realize it's really not that big. You know, it's kind of petty that we argue or get upset about this.
And some of these things can be avoided by just some of the tools that we give them. So like listening and communicating effectively, those are things that you do sometimes at work. You put on your customer service voice. You know what I'm saying? You speak gently to right. people at work. Then you get home and it's like your partner sometimes gets the worst version of you. And it's because it's a safe space.
I wish
space.
You quit describing my home life like, like that. But anyway.
And we all do it, but it's like, you have to be mindful of like, no, this is my person. They chose me. Your partner chose you for you. Like your parents, they made you. Your friends, they choose you for you. They like you. But your partner, they're choosing you for like the good, the bad, the ugly.
Right.
And I think we highlight it so that people can see like you both are here. So that means that you're both invested. Because you can be doing, it's on Saturday mornings. You could be sleeping. You could be doing whatever you want to do, but right. you're here in these sessions because this person matters to you.
Right.
And
right.
then we also talk about, you know, maybe this relationship is not. Like, our goal isn't to push the relationship. If you come up with these tools or your goals don't align with each other, we've had a couple who really have identified that, you know, we've got different goals for ourselves and it's not aligning.
It's hard to let go.
Right.
And it's hard to love somebody and say, this relationship isn't working for me. Because sometimes it is the repair. So that's why we do these workshops, these specific trust, communication, goal alignment, vulnerability, conflict resolution, intimacy. We touch on those topics because that's what makes it work. Mm-hmm. But if there are like foundational issues that are just, it's too far, we can't, you know, we can't I can't move past this, or I can't still be in a relationship with you because I'm too hurt. And sometimes couples take a break after they're like, you know what, these conversations were helpful and I got some closure. And then other times they're like, you know, we do want to work on this, but right. You're the experts. Like, we just give you the tools. You decide where you want to go.
Right. And even if they decide this isn't the relationship they want to be in all the way to the end, these are tools to build a friendship, to learn how to communicate. These are tools that you can actually use in other areas of your life, mm-hmm. but it helps them identify, communicate, and that this isn't working.
Let's jump back to our boot camps here. This is some really interesting discussion, and it's revealing because it seems like, though we're talking about couples, there are lots of different parts of this that just seem to, I mean, these are things that all of us.
It's self-work.
Really. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's self-work. All about, you think it's your partner, but it's really you working on you. How do I listen? Am I a good listener?
Right. Yes. Right.
What's my communication style? Can I be assertive, or am I more passive aggressive or passive? And then I get mad later because I'm not being heard.
Right.
Those things that you do so you know more about yourself, so then you can know what you're looking for in someone else.
Mm-hmm. So communication is a big part of this, and it's one of your workshops mm-hmm. as well, mm-hmm. right? So, all right, so we've used the plexiglass with the sticky notes on it already. Right. What do we do with the communication? How do you walk people through that?
With communication, we go through different communication styles. So are you a person that talks, or we talk about listening as well. So if you talk, are you talking to get your point across, and then you're listening to the other person get their point across? Because some people talk and other people just listen, so their turn can come and they're like really defensive, ready to be on defense to argue why this happened.
Oh.
So we also teach that, and then they're able to identify where they stand with their communication styles.
And we talk about like the role of the speaker, the role of the listener, and then some like cultural norms. So like we do communication workshops with couples, but we do it for organizations, like employees as well. Mm-hmm. And we do some examples. So for example, like because of our cultural norms, if I'm like, oh, I smell my partner or the person next to me's breath is a little stinky, I'm not going to say, ew, your breath is stinky, because it's just not appropriate. It's not
sure,
polite, you know?
Sure.
But you might say, hey, would you like a piece of gum? So this is indirect, but you're getting your point across. But it's just things like, it's some things like that, that you kind of don't communicate as effectively as we should because of some cultural barriers. Sometimes it's just personality differences, but we're trying to get people to be as assertive as they can so that people don't have to make assumptions about what you mean.
Right.
You say what you mean and mean what you say.
Right. And it also ties in with our conflict resolution. So the way you talk to your partner, what is your goal? What are you looking for when you talk to them? And what are you expecting to receive when they're talking to you?
Conflict resolution is big because everyone experiences conflict. It's normal. But also you want to resolve conflict in a way that you're not having the same fight. If you feel like you're having the same fight over and over again, it's because it's not resolved.
Right.
And people have areas where they're like, yeah, you know, we did argue. Well, I have to keep saying the same thing. It's like, well, it's a communication breakdown. And then also with our conflict resolution workshop. So since I'm a mediator, I infuse some of that into it as well, because sometimes, especially men and women, they process information differently. So sometimes men are more often likely to be straight to the solution. And women are more focused on the emotional process. It's like, you didn't hear what I said. Like, I could solve the problem myself, but you're not listening to how it affected me.
Right.
And then the other partner may be like, who cares? I got you to the solution, you know?
Right.
So just, we focus on both. I have this visual. It's like a train. You need both train tracks to get through a conflict. Mm-hmm. You can't just only focus on logic, and you can't only focus on emotion. So we go through both so that everyone's needs can come out and be addressed in the process, because sometimes some people just need to be heard.
Yeah,
and
solution.
The solution may be, you might have, so maybe we disagree and maybe you get your solution that you wanted, but I feel heard and I feel better. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. Mm-hmm.
So conflict resolution, break it down for us. How you approach explaining this to somebody, and then it's one thing to explain. Like you said, you can be at a seminar and I can tell you about it. But what you do with these workshops, these boot camps, is you help people see it for themselves.
Yeah, so we have a case example, but we also always open it up to see if anyone has a personal example that they want to use.
Right.
And those conversations, people get really invested.
I
so
bet.
It's interesting, uh-huh. But I give a general case example, which it may be, like we said, Adam wants to move out of town, Bella doesn't. Uh-huh. And then we go through, like, how do we generate options that can be beneficial to Bella and options that can be beneficial to Adam? And then is there any overlap? But we don't start off with just eliminating bad ideas, because there are no bad ideas. That's uh-huh. what I tell people. because a bad idea, in quotes, can get you to a good idea.
Okay.
So sometimes it's like, no, that's dumb. No, don't do that. Because, you know, now it also, for your partner, the emotional piece is, now it's like, do you think I'm dumb? Or should I not say I have an idea when I'm not sure if I should share it? So you don't want to have that in this idea generating stage. So we start with that, as many options as we can generate. And then that's when we evaluate, okay, which ones are beneficial for both of them? Because sometimes with conflict, people think that, or at least when they present their problems in the groups, they think that Adam moving out of town and Bella not moving out of town is mutually exclusive. But it's usually not. There's usually some area where you can, when you get down to there, that's just their position on the outside. But the reasons why they, you know, feel the way they feel, when you dig into that, they're like, oh, okay, Bella just wants to be closer to family. She has family near Adam's family out of town. So those things. But if you don't get to that, the underlying concerns, you'll be like, oh, we don't agree. And now it's the whole big situation when it could be, it's not mutually exclusive. They can come close together. It's a great area that can benefit both of you. But you have to do all of the work to get there.
Yeah. It's digging deep in that communication.
Right.
So you need to just say, you know, I am being here. I feel lonely. I feel, you know, isolated.
Vulnerability.
Yeah, vulnerability plays a huge role in every part of the boot camp. But once we give them the verbiage, because we do a
emotions wheel.
Emotions wheel. That
an
covers,
emotions wheel?
Yes. And with that, like we say, oh, I'm mad or I'm sad or I'm hurt. But then there's other words like
more descriptive, more effective. Like when we're socialized as young kids, you're like, okay, the core emotions are happy, sad, you know, mad.
Happy, sad, mad.
Yeah,
that's about it.
And it's funny, her, my granddaughter, her daughter says, oh, look it, she's mad if she see a picture. Or she's like, oh, she's sad. So she does, and it's so funny with the emotion wheel. She doesn't
only
even
two.
Know the other emotions.
Yeah. But you learn it so early that it's ingrained in you. So you're like, if someone says they're mad, you're like, oh, I'm angry, I'm mad. But what does that really mean? What does it look like? And when you can pinpoint and get more descriptive in what you're really feeling, then your partner can show up for you in a way that's appropriate. So for example, I say that mad anger is like a gateway to your true emotion rather than it really being an emotion. Because when you say I'm angry, when you dig deeper into it, you may be, I'm feeling hurt. I'm feeling
embarrassed,
threatened. And when someone says, like, if I come to you and I say, I'm feeling embarrassed, that's, you can show up to me differently to eliminate what made you feel embarrassed in the follow-up questions versus if I say I'm mad. Because when I say I'm mad, you might be like, oh, you know, I'm gonna give you some space.
Yeah. Curious about also how you gauge success in these workshops. How do you look at it?
Well, I think whatever they get out of it is their success makes us feel like they've learned something.
Okay.
So we do a pre-survey and a post-survey.
Hmm.
So we compare those to see if they gained anything out of it and if we need to change something because maybe we didn't address issues that would have been more beneficial to them. But I think our success is normally from their feedback or their interaction. So if we start off and it's like only one of the members of the couple that's really talking, and by the time we get to the end of it, they're both participating, they're both asking questions, I feel like we've made a breakthrough.
I agree. I think it's engagement and then seeing that they're having these tough conversations, because we're not invested in the outcome of your relationship. We're invested in you two as individuals as you work together in this intimate relationship. So we want you to feel like you learn more about yourself, you learn more about your partner. And some of that comes out in just our interactions with them and the things that they share, how they communicate, even in the group setting. And then, like she said, the pre and post test, we do it before the first group session and after about those topics that we cover. And then we do it again on the second group session, so that we can see, you know, was it beneficial? Do you feel like you learned anything? That's the one thing. Did you learn anything?
No. Right.
Whether it's from our presentation or it's from your interaction from the exercises that we did. Mm-hmm. That is a victory for us because we want you to feel like you learn more about yourself or your partner and just you gain some tools. And we give them tools from each workshop so that they can have, we talked about things, but these is how it actually, you can do it in your real life. And they get to keep those so that they can apply them in their life as they go on.
We say go into your toolkit. So we give them a toolkit with their paperwork telling them, you know, these are things that you agreed to do in your relationship. And a lot of times, like creating date night, creating a ritual, like when you leave, maybe saying, I love you, or give a kiss, or just stand by, I'm leaving, compared to just walking out. You know, we pretty much, whatever they say they want, we just reinforce it in their toolkit.
Okay. All right. I'm back to the partner who's not talking that much at the beginning of things. Is it pretty universal that by the time these workshops are done that most everybody's talking at a pretty good rate?
Yeah. People are open by then. Like, we do 3 workshops in the first group session. The first workshop, you know, people may be a little more quiet. By the second hour, they're more open. They're sharing more. Because some of the activities are, discuss this with your partner. I put music on so that the people don't feel like, oh, everyone's listening.
Right. That's a good idea.
And then they can report, you know, how did that feel? Did you learn anything? And it's not about what you learned. It's just like, did you learn something? But by the second group, it's like, share, you know, what did you gain from this? And it's more open. People tend to be more open because it's so vulnerable and intimate because the groups are small, that they feel like they met each other. They see each other.
Right. And when someone shares something related to the other couple, they'll give feedback to another couple. They're like, oh yeah, we used to be like that, but now. So it does open up that line of communication.
Do some of the couples connect? I mean, are there connections building during these sessions, do you see?
They connect while they're there. I don't know if afterwards when
they're walking out and becoming friends and taking vacations together and stuff like that necessarily.
I mean, hopefully, as we do more and more and we have a bigger base of our people that went through our boot camp, then maybe it may evolve into a bigger platform in that way. Right. But right now, it's like you see other people in relationships that are trying. And I think that that provides comfort too, because sometimes if you're the only person in your circle who's in a relationship, it can be like, I don't really have people to turn to or role models or, you know, not even to tell you step by step, but like my friends, I'm the only person in a relationship. So I don't know.
We actually had that in our first boot camp. And I think a little bit in this one, they said, you know, I've never seen, growing up, I didn't see a lot of positive marriages in my family. So they didn't know what to actually give their partner.
Or what to expect.
Yes.
What they're looking for.
Right. They really didn't know. And as far as the intimacy part, saying I love you, we had people say, you know, growing up, people didn't tell me that they love me. So it's hard for me to tell other people. So for me, it's been a lot of breakthrough. And it's been like, wow, this is really amazing, because people have reached back to us from our initial one and said, you know, thank you so much. I'm still working with the tools you gave us.
Or some people, they transition from the boot camp into long term counseling with us. So we really designed the boot camp to get your foot wet. If you're like, I want to do counseling, but it's a lot of stigma with it. So if they're like, I'm not really sure if this is something that we both want to do, you do the boot camp for a month. If that was enough for you for now, good. If you're like, hey, I loved working with you guys and we still have so much more work to do, they come and they come see us as couples after.
And how do you send off couples when it's all said and done? Do you have a... It's not a graduation or anything like that. I
mean, we do.
Do you have a graduation?
We do. If you survive the full four
survive,
weeks.
Survive. That's a really great marketing there.
It's intense. I tell people, like, it's intense. Like, all it's not just like, oh, it's a passive thing. Like, I signed up for this and then I'm not, like, engaging. Like, no, you have, it's hands-on. Everything is hands-on. So once you finish to the fourth week, I'm like, it's something to celebrate, to show that you complete this investment together, and that shows that you can work together and have these hard conversations. So now, hopefully, you don't have to have these same conversations again, because you should have some resolve.
Right.
That was Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis of Walking Through Solutions, LLC. We close today's show with another J. Moran conversation, this time with Andre Stokes, the Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health, as they discuss the importance of men speaking out on the stigma surrounding mental health.
What about men's mental health awareness? Are enough men aware of mental health and the possibilities and the possible pitfalls out there?
I would say a lot more men are becoming more aware since we have a much larger movement on mental health awareness, and that's something that I definitely love to see. There are still a number of folks who are less aware of men's Mental Health Awareness Month, and I think that's where the community does a lot, or can do, continue to do a lot to bring more awareness, to kind of reach those hard to gather individuals for the Awareness Month.
How about for you as a professional counselor? Those conversations, maybe people just find out, oh, you're in mental health. So that, do you get that, oh, that's for other people kind of a thing sometimes? Or is there more, do you see that interest lighting up like, oh, maybe you have some answers for me?
I definitely see the interest when okay. it's brought up. I see the interest, and that's another beautiful thing to see, because I know during previous decades, it would be more of a, that's not for me, and that's for other people. But now, since we have a new awareness about it, it's definitely piqued the interest of a lot of people who may have not been able to have that interest if this was 1980s, 1990s. So it's good to be in the present time where we are more open about that and can do a little bit more to support the needs of the folks who have them.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree that the awareness of mental health issues, mental health self-care are much, certainly we hear more about it today than we did, like you said, 10, 20, 30 years ago, for sure. What has changed, would you say? What is driving that awareness?
I think what drives that awareness is, it can be broken down into a few things. I think the first and foremost, there's the increase of the opioid epidemic and the addiction aspects that kind of plague most or all communities, rather. And where there's addiction, there's a mental health component as well, because
right.
those
you don't always
things,
make that connection, maybe, right?
Yes, yeah. they're very, very connected, just like a DNA sequence.
Sure.
So since we are kind of working through an addiction epidemic, that helps bring forth the awareness for mental health, and having one thing bounce off another can be very, very beneficial for the types of interventions and reactions that a lot of agencies and a lot of the culture has on that.
Okay. And let's just explore that connection. And like you said, that's unfortunately, it's taken something like the opioid epidemic to help drive awareness of mental health.
Yes.
Let's maybe push it maybe before the before the addiction occurs. I guess our personalities, to a certain extent, this where I'll show my ignorance on the level of mental health, but there's certain types of personalities or certain characteristics that might lend themselves to addictive behavior, for lack of a better term. What about, I mean, just in terms of mental health care, and you know, whether you're a parent who's watching their child come into these ages where, of course, there's so many pitfalls out there, advice for them, or even just for any of us out there, things that we should know about ourselves, things that we should be checking to make sure that we can stay above, you know, the unfortunate things that happen to those who become addicted, and we see it happens to everybody.
Yes. Yeah, some of the things that I would say we can check within ourselves are our social settings,
okay.
first and foremost. So I always say, be mindful of your diet. And by diet, I'm not talking about what you eat and what you, what you consume in your stomach. I'm talking about your intellectual diet, your social diet.
Okay.
What are the things that you are consuming socially within your area, within your surroundings, the things you hear, the things you're watching and listening to on social media and television and so forth? I think those have a significant impact on some of our decision making. You know, so for example, sometimes we listen to, you know, society has a kind of a relationship with media.
No doubt.
And media can sometimes perpetuate behaviors and lifestyles that are counterproductive to real life people. And it can be difficult for some folks to kind of see the line between their actual life and what they're consuming in their diet on TV and in social media. And we all have phones in our pockets too, so we have that easy access to some of the things that may not be within our best interest as far as lifestyle.
Best interest. Okay, that's a great term to use right there. What's in our best interest? And I guess let's explore that just a little bit. Best interest. Everything's individualized, of course, and I'm sure it goes case to case. But still, there probably are some things that you're seeing that stand out.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I think some of the things that I see that stand out are also the way we perceive certain things that happen to us. So when we're dealing with certain types of trauma. We have options to react to that trauma. We could, you know, kind of keep ourselves at a certain level by not addressing, or we can address those traumas by doing whatever we need to do on a therapeutic level. And by therapeutic, I don't necessarily mean always clinical,
okay,
but just for ourselves. What can you do alone? Or what can you do without the intervention of someone else? You know, so...
What,
you know,
okay, counselor, what can I do? Of course, well, I've got you for the next hour, so I've got you. I've got lots of things to talk about. Sorry.
That's okay. That's all right.
But yeah, that's fine. So what are some of those things that perhaps, like you said, going to a counselor, going to a professional, always a great option. We're hearing that more. We're seeing that more. That's great. But what about what we can do for ourselves?
Mm-hmm. I would say... time management. So time management definitely plays a role in mental health and some of our triggers.
Really?
Yes. So when we're thinking about time management, we have to consider the things that we have to do in our daily adventures, our daily duties. So making sure that we are time sensitive and kind of keeping on track with, I want to say due dates, but due times, mm-hmm, can help us with the stress levels. And of course, as we know, the stress levels, if not addressed, lead to further mental health challenges such as anxiety, depression, or the exacerbation of other mental health diagnoses as well. So that's one of the newer things that I'm starting to explore, how time management and the essence of time itself can impact the way we feel and the way we think, which then impacts our decision-making process.
That's an interesting connection. Unfortunately, when you say time management, for me, it conjures up a stress about work. but I did. Right. I like the way you said the essence of time. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing about that? Because it sounds like something. This is also kind of maybe a new page for you to a certain extent of trying to understand that and relate that to people who are dealing with mental health issues.
Right. Right. So when folks are dealing with mental health issues, the essence of time is essential in the sense that when we're working through things, we want to make sure that we address them sooner rather than later.
Hmm.
If we're waiting and kind of prolonging and procrastinating on addressing those things, then that's more time. That's a bigger chunk of time. Where there's bigger chunks of time, that allows for opportunity for things to get inside those bigger chunks of time that may be maladaptive. Hmm. Different maladaptive behaviors such as negative coping mechanisms, drug use, and things like that, and so forth. So when we are able to shorten the amount of time between the problem and not the solution, but the start to considering a solution, then that's a way to kind of manage mental health symptoms overall.
Are you seeing that a lot in the people that you're talking with, or that you're helping, that time, that essence of time issue is a big part of things?
Right, absolutely. And it's a fine line. So when working with the community, I think it's important to also be careful to discuss time, but not in a way where they're being pushed or rushed into
not giving them deadlines necessarily.
Right. Okay. Just explaining how time is important within the essence of recovery and kind of tying it into, let's say, physical health. If you have a chronic illness, of course, you will want your doctor to intervene with, you know, whatever treatments or medications or interventions that are needed sooner rather than 6, 8, 9 months from now. Because within a 6, 8 month period, a year long period, other things can happen.
Right.
Other physical ailments can begin, or they can increase if you already have them. So just making sure that folks are aware of the importance of time rather than rushing them and saying, you got to go to treatment. You have to do this. You have to do it now. Not everybody can move now. Some people need time to process. We all need time to process, right, as a matter of fact. So just keeping it on the board so that people can see how time impacts the way we feel from the mental health perspective, I think is very, very important.
I would think it might be a surprise. If I was coming to you when you were helping me and you would turn to me and say, you know, how are you managing your time? Or how come we've been talking about this for the last 3 months and you haven't done X? I mean, I guess how quickly can people really relate to the idea that what you're trying to say right here, that you're only exacerbating this problem by delaying it?
Yeah, sometimes some people can catch on really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think that depends on the delivery and the relationship someone has with their counselor.
All right.
So if it's a new counselor or someone, not a new counselor, but someone that's new to them, I would imagine it has a far less chance of sticking.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you build that rapport with someone, they're more likely to kind of listen to what you're saying and receive it in a different way, in the way that it's intended. And a lot of that can come from not just the relationship that they have with their therapist, their counselor, or their provider, but also their connection with them from a background perspective as well.
As you're talking here, I'm seeing you kind of work through how you are dealing with different individuals. And I'm wondering for you, do you have to have a lot of different approaches to how you're going to address these issues? It seems to me like you have to read the room a little bit and read the individual. Yes. How do you go about making those determinations? Or is it just trial and error?
Sometimes it is trial and error, but sometimes, most of the time for me at least, it's reading the room. Mm-hmm. So being able to take that time to feel someone out, feel their energy, connect with them, and see how they react to certain things you say, you begin to learn to pick up on those things. So as you kind of make the assessment, the personal assessment, not the actual assessment on paper for why they are there, but that personal assessment, you get a feel of where you can go with that person within, let's say, 15 minutes.
Okay.
And using that to your advantage, I think, is very, very important when figuring out the best ways to provide a service to someone. So you can provide the same type of service ending, but in most cases, you'll have to do it differently for each person, depending on how they perceive what you're saying.
I'm intrigued about this in the sense, and I also want to put the disclaimer out there, and anytime I think I'm walking over that bridge into confidentiality, I want to make sure that you know that mm-hmm. that's the case. That I want to make sure I'm respectful of that.
Thank you.
But okay, but what can you give me maybe an example or a general idea of? Okay, I see this when I saw this reaction, and then I had to change course.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of an example like that you could share?
Absolutely, absolutely. So a few years ago, I worked with an individual who came in for counseling, for treatment. And during my assessment process, I assessed that this person would be good for an inpatient stay at another place. So I gently mentioned an inpatient stay, but not from the perspective of this person going to inpatient.
Okay.
I mentioned an inpatient treatment facility and what they have just to see how this person would react.
Okay.
And I was looking to see if they would say, inpatient, that's for someone else. I don't need that. Or if the response would be on the opposite end of the spectrum and say, oh, really? Well, I can understand how inpatient treatment would work for a person who's struggling with some of the things that I struggle with.
Yeah.
So kind of gauging, you know, kind of fishing. Right. Let's call it fishing.
All right, so you have that idea in mind, and then you see. So what are you looking for? Physical reaction, just a verbal reaction? What do you got?
Both.
Yeah.
I like to look at body language.
Yeah.
So when someone is more leaned back like this, they're comfortable.
Okay.
They're I don't want to say comfortable, that might be a reach, but they're less uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But when someone starts to fidget when you mention certain things, it's like, okay, that's an area that they may not be comfortable with. So when you see the fidgeting start, kind of pivot a little bit and go left and go down a different street to get them to fidget less and get them to lean back a little bit more.
Okay.
When you're able to get people to lean back, they're listening more. They're listening more with intent, and they're going to be less likely to battle what you're saying.
Just curious, did you see me fidgeting when you were talking about time management?
Yes.
Wow, you're really good. Andre Stokes is with us. Andre is the Senior Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health. All right, how about time of the year? Time of the year. We're heading into summer where life can get going real fast. We want to be laid back, like you were saying right there, but we also know that there's only so much time in the summer. What are some of the things that maybe, you know, I'm sure there's a variety of things that happen year-round in terms of mental health issues, but what maybe might we see at this time of the year?
I think in the summertime, when it gets warmer, the data shows that overdoses tend to increase.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. More people are spending more time outside because the weather is very appropriate. And when folks are able to go outside, they're able to meet a little bit more and to spend more time with the people that they associate with.
Mm.
In turn, that has a connection to increased substance use versus the colder months. There's more gatherings, there are more parties, there's you know, just more outside time in general. And when people are able to get together, things can happen. Versus wintertime, November, December, people can't really go outside like they want to. So having that, the increase in social activity increases substance use as well.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's a thing right now.
Yes.
Any words of advice? You know, we can speak to the individual who might find themselves in it, but words of advice for friends, family members, you know, parents, that about that. I mean, or maybe just the idea, like you said, mm-hmm. this is the time of the year to be on the alert for it.
Right. I would say also be sure to enjoy your time. Enjoy the summer. You know, we only get 10 minutes of summer a year in Buffalo.
Yes.
So enjoy that time while we have it, but also be mindful and keep an eye out on your family members, your loved ones, anybody that you think might be struggling, because the warmer months is where things are more likely to happen. So enjoy your time, but enjoy your time in a way that is a bit more wise and a bit more aware of the surroundings and the things that are happening in each community.
You're talking about your conversations with the people you're trying to assist, that you're short on demands. You're not looking to you don't give a lot of that. At the same time, when somebody may have already be dealing with a substance abuse issue, like you said, it's summertime. You're going to bump into your friends again.
Mm-hmm.
You know what could happen there. We know all about best intentions. Talk about that dynamic about what people should be watching for and what happens to them. I'm resolved. I'm not going to go down that road again. I've done that before. Yet you're getting together the same party that you've gone to the last three summers, and we know what happened there. How do you address those?
I like to, when I see those and I address those, I like to talk about how individuals are not only more likely to party, but they're more likely to get into things that might be harder.
Hmm.
The springtime and the summertime are times for the introduction of new substances. So
really?
Kind of that quote unquote graduation phase.
Hmm.
And, you know, when folks are new to substances, then they may develop newer problems or more intense problems. So in addition, when folks are in treatment and trying to walk that path, I think it's important to be mindful of coping mechanisms and new skills that they may have learned with their provider, with their counselor, such as being able to kind of redirect conversations when they approach, when they're at hand, and being able to say no, but in a way that's comfortable for them. So a lot of times when we think about the word no, that's hard for some people.
Yeah.
That can be very challenging for some people, especially folks in addiction. When the word no not only means I'm not going to socialize, but it also may mean that I'm not going to get this particular thing that I like to use.
Right.
So getting people comfortable with the idea of rejecting opportunities, but in a graceful manner that they're most comfortable with, is very important to maintaining the path that they're trying to walk. And that can be very difficult when a lot of things are present in the summer because we're outside and we're able to do things. We're able to go places. So learning the no, but not necessarily just a no, because that can be challenging, but learning how to word it in a way that is graceful and more redirective versus a refusal. So, for example, hey, do you want to go here? We have this new thing that we want to try.
Mm.
It could be option A could be no, or option B could be, well, I'd really rather get to my appointment because I've been working with XYZ for 3 months. I'd really rather do that. Or I have, you know, to go pick up my kids from this place at that time, so I won't be able to do it, and things like that. So it's helpful to allow people to learn how to say no, but in an indirect way, and to add a prior engagement into that response.
Graduation into other substances. Boy, that's a daunting way of yes. looking at graduation, isn't it? But yes. But it's something that's true. What are we seeing? What are you seeing in terms of what people are dealing with right now? I mean, you know, fentanyl, of course, has been the big substance that we've been hearing a lot about in the last year or two. Mm-hmm. What about right now?
Yes, fentanyl is it's everywhere. It's in, especially with our youth. We have to be a lot more careful with our youth because they're, of course, not fully developed, and they're more impressionable. And being impressionable increases the chances of a youth trying some new things. And you mentioned fentanyl. Fentanyl isn't everything. There's more fentanyl in cocaine now than there is in heroin. So folks are, you know, experimenting with new things, and fentanyl is in, it's in marijuana. It's everywhere. And we have to be mindful of the way we teach substance use to children as well, because it could be, you think you're trying something, but then that could also be an overdose, and worst case scenario, the loss of another person. So keeping that in mind is, I think, very, very important for everyone, but especially our youth, because it's the summertime. Kids are outside. They want to play basketball. They want to do sports. They want to swim. All the kids have friends. Some of the friends do things, and it can be a transition period.
And just to clarify, though, it's slightly outside your realm. No matter, especially when it comes to youth, access to these substances is universal right now?
Yes. Yes.
It doesn't matter, city, suburbs, rural.
Does not matter. The substances, the addiction itself, the access to the substances does not discriminate. It's everywhere, every town, every corner. Some towns may do a little bit better at hiding it, but it's everywhere, and the access it's there.
And that will do it for Producer's Picks. We thank our guests, Deja Middlebrook, LaShawn Davis, and Andre Stokes. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or on the Amplify BTPM app. Each episode is online at wbfo.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thanks for listening.